Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. ProPublica last week reported that advertisers on Facebook can use the social media giant's own algorithms to target users with a history of anti-Semitic activity. Facebook says that such advertiser activity is policed by human moderators, but such monitoring is done on a piecemeal basis. And there's more. Facebook has recently admitted that Russian actors exploited Facebook's ad service to spread misinformation during the 2016 presidential election. Wired senior writer Issy Lepowski recently weighed in on the issue. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How did ProPublica conduct the investigation?
So ProPublica has been investigating Facebook's ad algorithms from many sides. Last year, they discovered that they were able to block housing ads from reaching black Facebook users, and they did it by just trying to buy the ads themselves. So they approached this issue much the same way. They tried to place $30 worth of ads against terms or people who have listed terms like Jew hater, how to burn Jews, why Jews ruin the world, under their interests or employers or their field of study. These are self-reported categories on Facebook, so instead of Facebook listing the category, you're free to say, you know, whoever your employer is or whatever your interests are. And so ProPublica went ahead and tried to place $30 worth of ads against those categories, and within 15 minutes, those ads were approved.
They were approved, but do we know how much that's actually happening out there?
Right. Well, that
it can be done. Is it being done?
Exactly. That's Facebook's big defense, which is that this is a fringe case. And that's almost always Facebook's defense when, you know, they get caught in situations like this. They say of all the, you know, millions of categories out there, there is such a small subset of people who would ever even choose to list any of these heinous categories as their interests. And so just the fact that it was available doesn't mean that anybody is actually seeing it. The flip side of the argument is that, okay, maybe nobody has used it for this purpose yet, but we really don't know if that is true or not. And furthermore, it's like setting up a time bomb that's just waiting to go off.
So there haven't been any complaints filed. You don't know of anyone who's actually says that this is happening.
Well, I don't. Actually, ProPublica is compiling as many troublesome ads as they can. They set up what they are calling a pack, and they are asking people to crowdsource their experiences with Facebook ads that look a little fishy to them. Facebook says, you know, ProPublica is digging for this stuff that, you know, they're on this sort of fishing mission to bring Facebook down. But the argument could be made that Facebook should be undertaking this very kind of hunt themselves to unearth the troublesome categories that they allow people to target against. It should be noted that after ProPublica approached Facebook with this problem, Facebook did take immediate action, and they are now preventing anyone from advertising against these user self-reported categories. So in other words, in the past, Facebook's advertising tool would basically scrape every user's page, and if they found enough pages that listed, for instance, Jew hater, they would turn that into a category. Facebook is no longer doing that, and the hope is that that will prevent any of these, you know, ugly user-generated categories from manifesting into actual ads.
How does the algorithm work? I know we don't know what makes up the algorithm, but if I'm a Facebook, I want to advertise on Facebook. How does that? What's the process like?
Well, those are two different questions. So
okay.
I think the algorithm is, you know, it's a term that's often used. And the algorithm does dominate a lot of what happens on Facebook. It dominates what we see in our news feed, and it dominates how ads go out. In this case, it was really a one-to-one situation. The system scraped all of these user profiles, and it just picked up categories that it saw out there that existed on multiple pages.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not so much, you know, a secret sauce algorithm. It's basically Facebook trying to reflect the categories that its users have told Facebook that it's interested in, right? That's Facebook's whole goal, is to sort of create a world in which any, you know, microscopic interest can become an interest group that advertisers can advertise toward. In a lot of cases, you don't really want to allow that to happen, which is the case here.
So Facebook scrapes the interests, the topics that appear in the interests. They create categories when there's a critical mass of these. Jew hater might be one of the categories. What does an advertiser then do to tap into that, whether it's a lover or a hater? What does an advertiser do to tap into that then?
Sure. When you're setting up your ad on the back end, you tabulate through to interests, and you can find these categories. And in fact, not only can you find one of these categories, but Facebook will then suggest related categories that you might also want to advertise against. And that's how ProPublica sort of grew its audience, because there was no one term that was large enough to place an ad against. But when you group a few of them together, you suddenly have a group of, you know, say 2,000 people that you can advertise to.
Mark and Hilliard, you're on the air with Issy Lepowski of Wired. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to point out that the ProPublica article was fairly sensationalistic, but that, you know, it and many of the other articles out there sort of based on ProPublica's reporting did not discover that any anti-Semitic ads had ever been placed by anybody, only that it was theoretically possible to do this using Facebook's system.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they chose something that would be extremely sensationalistic. And you know, in many cases, they basically implied that such ads had been placed when in fact they hadn't. And I felt that this was pretty unfair to Facebook, not making clear that no such ads had been placed.
Issy Lepowski?
Sure. Well, I certainly see your point, but I would say that there's an important question to be asked here, which is, why does Facebook allow this type of category to begin with? Because we frankly don't know whether it's been used in the past. And you're right that the ProPublica story doesn't necessarily establish that it has been used, but it could have been used in the past. It could be used in the future if it hadn't been detected. Facebook should be aware of these things, and it's claiming that ProPublica brought these categories to it brought this entire problem to its attention for the first time, and that should make us skeptical that these companies are setting up these tech tools that have an enormous influence on people's news consumption, people's political views, and they're not monitoring them the way that they maybe ought to.
They say they do monitor and remove. And by the way, Mark, thanks a lot for that call. They say they do monitor and remove bad categories on a case-by-case basis. You say that that's not enough. Where's the tipping point for you when it comes to censoring versus, you know, just being good stewards of the public marketplace?
Well, Facebook has pretty hard and fast rules against hate speech on its platform. So by enabling these categories, they're violating their own rules. Forget what I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
They're violating their own rules that they've established for themselves, and they've admitted that. Facebook does already block ads that, for instance, include profanity. You can't target an alcohol ad to, you know, youths in certain parts of the United States. So they already put parameters on their ads, and given that they have banned hate speech on the platform, I think this it's not too much to ask mm-hmm. that they would look at this pretty seriously. I think you're right. It is a slippery slope, and they're often concerned about violating the free speech of their users, and I think are very concerned about overreach, because it could be that the same mechanism that, you know, allows you to block a racist or anti-Semitic ad might block ads that are relatively benign, and then you have a situation where you have users complaining that Facebook is censoring me, and I have a perfectly good cause that I'm trying to raise money for, or a small business that I'm trying to start up, and Facebook is preventing me from advertising. So it's not an easy problem to solve, but Facebook can never solve it if it remains blissfully ignorant to the fact that the problem exists to begin with.
It's hard to believe they were ignorant of the category existing. It's just a fact, right?
It is a fact. They maintain that they were not aware of it until ProPublica brought it up. Now, you can imagine that is not entirely truthful, but either they were actually ignorant to the problem or they were aware that there was a problem and decided to do nothing about it. And I don't think either one of those are a responsible way to manage a platform of 2 billion people.
So besides just following their own rules, as you pointed out, what else could they do?
Well, I think that they need to develop more sophisticated flags around hate speech. This has been brought up in the past that the way Facebook monitors hate speech on its platform is also troublesome. ProPublica did a separate investigation and found documents that showed how Facebook's human screeners are supposed to distinguish between what categories of people are protected and what categories of people are not protected. So, for instance, a protected group would include white men because that is a group that's based on race and gender, two categories that are both protected. It would not protect black children because children are considered to be a subset of black people, and subsets are not considered to be protected at Facebook. Now, I think if anybody looking at that from a more objective point of view saw that white men are protected but black children aren't, they would see that that's a problem. So I think Facebook, one thing that it can do is set up some teams internally or externally to morally vet its technology. You know, in the cybersecurity industry, it's considered a strength to have your code peer-reviewed. At Facebook and other tech platforms, they consider, you know, their algorithms and the way they build their technology, the way it works, to be their secret sauce. But clearly, there are major moral blind spots and vulnerabilities, and they keep popping up again and again. And Facebook can't consistently be in this position where it says, well, we didn't know, but now we're going to fix it. Mm-hmm. It needs to proactively address these things.
Changing, switching gears here a little bit, the Wall Street Journal has reported that Facebook shared records about the Russian-linked ad purchases on Facebook with special counsel Robert Mueller. What's going on here? There's a groups linked to Russia that used Facebook in the last election.
Right. So Facebook disclosed recently that it has detected $150,000 worth of ads that were in some way linked to Russian accounts. It found 470 accounts that were linked to a Russian troll farm. That's a term that's being used to describe a group that just spreads propaganda online. This is a well-known organization in Russia, and it found those accounts, 470 of them, and shut them down. It also found another set of accounts that were using Russian IP or were using English IP addresses, but set to Russian language. And so, just as a precaution, it also shut those accounts down. And the controversy here has been that we don't know what those ads looked like. We don't know what they said. Facebook has only revealed that they related to, you know, hot button social issues across the ideological spectrum. They have now shared that information with investigators, but the open question is whether that is just the tip of the iceberg with regard to what Russia spent on Facebook ads during the election. And the reason we can't know more about that is because Facebook remains so secretive about how it's even, you know, investigating these ads. We don't know, you know, what it actually is looking for, what breadcrumbs it's looking for. Hopefully, Investigator Mueller's team will be able to sort of vet those approaches and maybe look for more clues.
Any sense about what kind of deal Facebook might have cut with the investigators' team to in order to reveal what they have already?
I think that's unclear. I think we're seeing that that Mueller's team is using some pretty intense tactics.
Yes,
to
they
get
are.
What they,
yes. Exactly.
Yeah, news broke that they pinned the lock on. Yeah, well, exactly, and picking a lock on Paul Manafort's home and raiding his home. So I think Facebook is well aware that this is a high profile case as high profile as possible, and the optics of resisting investigators in this instance may be worse than whatever comes out of the investigation, or at least I imagine that's what they're hoping. But I think that this is a distinct issue from the anti-Semitic ads, but they both lead to the same conclusion, which is that there is a substantial lack of oversight over Facebook's advertising system, and that is having severe repercussions.
Izzy Lipowski, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Izzy Lipowski is a senior writer for Wired. We'll put a link to her story on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Amish are known for living apart from most modern technology. They use horses and buggies and ignore television and many also electricity. Smartphones and computers have challenged that way of life, however. Joining us now is senior staff editor on the business desk at The New York Times, Kevin Granville. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thank you.
How and when, I guess, is the starter question, did computers and mobile phones gain a foothold where cars and other modern conveniences failed?
Well, you know, one thing about the Amish is that they are very competitive in business. And as they have moved increasingly off farms, they're wanting to get more into business, into various enterprises, and as they do that, whether it's a restaurant, whether it's a gazebo, a manufacturing plant, they find they need computers and cell phones to do the work and to compete, and so they've used them and adapted them and felt comfortable with them. You know, whether it's having a credit card reader at the checkout of a store, or using computers to run the inventory on at your manufacturing plant. They've sort of adapted and gotten to use them. They've tried to draw a line between use of cell phones and internet access to keep it at work and less of it at home or not at home at all. But it's caused some concern among the Amish themselves about mm-hmm. the way that cell phones especially can be, you know, kind of insidious and become part of our lives.
Gee, that's a new idea.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah. We see this ourselves, and they're kind of afraid of that arriving on, you know, on their properties. It has caused some concern among them. The younger people don't feel as don't feel as restricted about using the cell phones. they are trying to find that line of where their home life can be, can follow their religious doctrines, while also being competitive in the business world.
Who's trying to find that line? I mean, is this a community wide mm-hmm. search, or is it on a house by house basis? How do they do that?
It's a community thing. I mean, the Amish are very community oriented. Now there are many Amish communities and many sort of districts and churches. And someone I spoke to said, you know, if there are 1,300 Amish communities, there are 1,300 ways to be Amish.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure people understand, some are much more conservative and traditional than others. We spent time in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, which has a pretty large Amish community. but which is also somewhat outward facing. You know, it's not too far from Philadelphia, and they one fellow I talked to who's Amish, he runs a popular restaurant in Philadelphia, a sandwich making shop, and so they so this group in Lancaster are, you know, it concerns them. They're trying to find that line, but it's they're very community oriented, and that's almost what disturbs them about cell phones, is that they kind of draw one inside. You know, they're very individualistic. Modern technology is, you know, it's all about freedom. It's all about do your own thing and listen to your own music. Whereas they really like the community aspect, that we are in this all together. You know, that we have this image of a barn raising where everyone comes together. That's not an inaccurate, you know, image.
But if I drop my cell phone in the water, will everyone join in and help me replace it?
Well, right. No, I mean, they some people would probably say leave it in the water. It's probably the best place for it.
What do we know about how many people, how many Amish have a smartphone? I mean, are there any statistics out there yet?
Not really, although, I mean, I asked that question, and some people who are pretty sharp observers of the scene, who are not Amish, but who really are in contact with them all the time, guess that maybe like half the households have a cell phone.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did they just, I want to talk a little logistics here with you for just a second.
Yeah.
If they don't, I mean, they have to have electricity to have a smartphone, right?
Right. And now they are, as someone told me, the Amish are the ultimate hackers in that they do have electricity. They just don't, what they don't do is connect to the power grid. You know, public utilities are not their thing.
Okay.
And so they have been very much on the forefront of using solar panels on their barns. They also use generators to create, you know, electricity on their property, diesel generators. They use batteries a lot. I mean, like big, heavy-duty, kind of like automobile-style batteries that they help run.
So they're not necessarily right, and that all makes sense now, because there's lots of Amish in Ohio, as you know, and you could drive by house after house. There's no connection to the grid. You're right. And yeah, that's really interesting. But so the idea is to stay apart from it all.
Yes.
But smartphones are the ultimate, even though they make you alone and separate from things, they're the ultimate connectivity.
That's true. And some people I spoke to said, you know, it's not all negative. A young person with a smartphone, with a Facebook account, can keep in touch with fellow Amish friends who are on Facebook, and it's a way to be together and share, you know, do whatever anyone does on Facebook, but do it within their community. That's one way to look at it. But there's also this fear that it's a gateway to whatever is out there.
Same fear anyone has.
Well, yeah, exactly. For pornography, for just anything that you don't want your youth or don't want people to have easy access to. The other thing about cell phones that kind of draws concern is that it's a thing that can, you know, be in your pocket, and you know no one quite knows you have it. A lot of the restrictions against technology that the Amish have are very visual in a way. You can tell if a house is not connected to the power, you know, the telephone wires. You can tell that they don't have a car in their driveway. You can perhaps look in the window and see they don't have a TV. So it's sort of a social thing to show that you are abiding by this. But, you know, a cell phone is pretty small. And as one professor I talked to who said, you know, an Amish boy can go out into the farm field and open up a cell phone and no one knows he has it and no one knows what he's doing. Perhaps the only people who do are, you know, his friends that he's talking to. So So we, you know, that's we've done stories about Amish and technology and how they've sort of adapted, mm-hmm. but this was, you know, in terms of internet access and cell phones, it was, you know, it was, we were sort of, you know, hitting a nerve as we talked to people about it.
Is it a source of conflict within Amish communities that you talk to?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't get, to be honest, I wasn't, you know, in our reporting, it was hard to sort of get into that level. Mm-hmm. It's not like we could sit in on their church discussions.
Right.
I got to believe that it is, only because, but you know, it may be between different communities. Some communities are more, like I said, more conservative than others. Mm-hmm. I think some would look askance that a household having a cell phone. Some even, you know, don't abide by, you know, the Amish taxis, you know, these cars that are driven by non-Amish, mm-hmm. that provide sort of taxi services, mm-hmm. to the Amish when they need to get somewhere. It's not uncommon to see these cars in Lancaster, but I think in some other parts of the country, some other Amish communities, it would be, you know, really rejected.
I know there's an Amish newspaper out there. Is there chatter on that?
That is a good question. I don't have the answer to that.
Yeah. What do you think? Well, I mean, when you talk to young Amish people, are they more like, this is no big deal, just like any kids?
Yeah, they do. I mean, they kind of feel like we have this in hand. You know, don't sweat it. It's fine. You know, keep in mind that also the Amish, they get baptized, you know, in their late teens or early 20s, and
right.
they sort of voluntarily join the faith. You know, it's not something that they are necessarily, even though it's a cultural thing, they have to commit themselves at that age. And so they the ones who stay, and the population keeps growing of the Amish, the ones who stay, you know, say it's fine. We know the lifestyle we lead here, and we'll keep it in hand.
Have there been any problems with it yet that you know of?
No. I mean, I don't know of any, you know.
I guess any young Amish people getting caught up in some kind of dating website, you know, or.
Yeah, it's a great question.
Nothing's.
Nothing that we came across.
Right, because they play it pretty close to the vest, right?
Yeah, they do. I mean, it's a hard community to crack.
Yeah.
And to get them to talk to you honestly, you know, they do their business and they'll sell you products and, but they sometimes can be a little, it can be a hard interview, to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you know, we were able to learn whatever we can.
What are the big businesses that are driving the Amish economy right now? Besides, because as you mentioned, I mean, farmland's getting too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
They're going into what are they selling? I mean, you mentioned the sandwich maker in Philadelphia, but in your article, you mentioned they're millionaires, some of them.
Well, yeah, I don't know if they're millionaires. They do have businesses that can do in excess of $1 million in sales.
Okay.
There are, I mean, if you go to Lancaster, they have huge restaurants. They serve kind of a tourist community. I mean, people come on buses from New York and from Philadelphia to do some shopping, mm-hmm. in the area, to eat, to buy the shoe fly pie and bring that home. But they also build one of the businesses that we spent some time in this article that we worked on was at a sort of a portico and gazebo manufacturing plant that is on the internet, and they'll build they have various number of models that they build, and they will send it you know, around the country and deliver it to your house, and so you walk into their you know, their manufacturing facility, and they have, you know, all the men are there with their beards and their suspenders and their hats, and they're using, you know, computer guided saws to build these wooden structures. I've I didn't see them myself, but I've heard there are, you know, there are computer repair shops that are run by the Amish. so they're, you know, it's not too limited. They do a variety of things.
What do the scholars who study the Amish way of life and Amish history, do they have any thoughts about what the advent of smart technology means to a community or any of the 1,400 Amish communities out there? What we're talking about here, is this a game changer?
Well, there's concern about that for sure. There's concern that this is like a challenge that they have not that they'll have to meet and try to figure out. It's not going to be as simple as a stricture about not owning cars or not being connected to the power grid. You know, this will be something that they'll have to adapt to and figure out. And it may be too late to do, you know, a ban, but they'll have to learn how to do it. You know, telephones for all the 20th century, they did not have telephones, but sometimes they would have a phone, you know, on the telephone pole down at the end of the driveway with that they could use. So they kind of found a way to live and maybe get the best of that technology over the years. They'll have to figure it out with cell phones. But I wouldn't bet against them. I don't think this is going to necessarily mean, you know, the end of the Amish, because people have been predicting their demise for, you know, for a long time. One thing I was surprised at was just how their population has grown over the years. You know, they have large families, and even though they may lose some children to other faiths or to no faith, I think they have an average of something like seven children. Again, these are all averages, and so if three go on to leave the family faith, you'll have four staying with you. So suddenly you have, where you had two parents, you now have four children who are Amish. So it's been growing.
Kevin Granville, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Sure thing.
Kevin Granville is a senior staff editor on the business desk at the New York Times. We'll put his article about Amish and smartphones on our website at WOSU.org. You can check out the link there. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. To keep a PC running smoothly these days, basic maintenance is usually required. For Windows users, that's meant occasionally running a file cleanup and performance optimization app called CCleaner. Unfortunately, users who have been diligent with that app may have also exposed themselves to malware. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holly. Hi, Russell.
Hello.
Okay, so what's CCleaner? What does it do?
Well, CCleaner is one of just a bunch of different apps that are made by companies that aren't Microsoft with the goal of maintaining your computer. It goes through and scans your PC and performs pretty basic maintenance and, you know, takes a look at files that may just be building up that you're not necessarily using in cache places and offers to clean it out for you. It's not something that everybody needs to do, but it is, you know, it is a service that that can make particularly older computers, run better depending on how they're used.
What happened?
Well, so the company that makes this software was, you know, they offer it on their website as something that that can be downloaded, and updates come regularly from this website, and the company was unaware that for 4 weeks hidden in their program was malware that was included in the program that would it would send encrypted information to attackers, including all kinds of kind of intricate details about the PC to make it easier to attack, and not just that PC, but also the network it was attached to. And this went on for 4 weeks until a security firm called Cisco Telos, discovered it and notified them and then notified the rest of the world.
Was this an inside job?
So there's still kind of a big report being compiled from Puriform, the company, about how this happened. That they're pretty tight-lipped on the how. It's entirely possible that a computer on their network responsible for compiling final versions of the program was under someone else's control, and so this kind of slipped in the last steps of releasing a program. Or it could very well have been someone working at Puriform who did this to see how many PCs it could be affected.
How many people do we know it affected?
We know that CCleaner has 2 billion users and something to the neighborhood of 5 million weekly installs, according to the CCleaner website. So a pretty significant chunk of people who own Windows computers and actively use, kind of maintenance software that isn't bundled into something like, McAfee or something like that, was using, CCleaner to a pretty regular basis.
So if you're one of those people, what do you do now?
Well, as a part of this, disclosure from Cisco Telos, all of the security firms that run things like antivirus, anti-malware software will have immediately updated their software, with kind of detection methods for this new thing. And so in many cases, CCleaner will have been kind of quarantined by a lot of those programs, so it won't be allowed to kind of touch other parts of the computer and reach out. And another update from CCleaner will have replaced the malicious software contained within it. And it's also not a bad idea to uninstall CCleaner entirely and just, completely, wipe your computer if you're not using regular kind of malware scanning software. Just kind of start over from scratch. But there are a bunch of different options available here. And both the internal Microsoft security protocols and the stuff from third parties will have taken care of most of it pretty much overnight.
But if they and the report's being compiled now about how it happened in the first place, until you know that, there's no way to know whether it could happen again.
It's definitely the kind of thing, the people responsible for CCleaner are going to have a lot of information available in order for the security, community to trust them at all. And for a lot of PC software people to recommend them to anyone.
And you said 2 billion people?
It is 2 billion global users.
Wow.
Was the last thing that the Puriform announced before they were acquired by Avast.
And any sense about what kind of damage has been done?
Honestly, it's not even clear how many people were actually attacked by CCleaner sending this information out right now. So it's really hard to say. But it's possible that, with 5 million weekly installs that network information for several million people are now, in the hands of someone who would go and do something malicious.
Okay, the latest, just the latest. Last week we spoke just before Apple's big event announcing their new phones. Let's go over the big news. Start with iPhone 8 and the iPhone 8 Plus. Was it pretty much what you predicted? Tell us.
Yeah, it was pretty much, if you look down at an iPhone 7 and kind of imagine glass on the back instead of just glass on the front, then you pretty much have an idea of exactly what the iPhone 8 looks like. It comes in a lot of the same colors as the current iPhone 7. There's small improvements to the camera and to the processor, but the display itself is going to stay the same. And a lot of the software that you're going to see is going to be the same. It really If you own an iPhone 7, there are going to be a lot of people looking at this new phone and wondering what exactly they're upgrading to and what, mm-hmm. What the new money is going to be for. And it's going to be a little while before we have a clear answer to that, aside from the camera is slightly better and it's a little faster.
Why do we have to wait?
Because the phone doesn't come out until this Friday.
Oh, okay. All right.
There are a couple of people around the world who have early versions of the phone to take a look at.
Okay.
It's going to be a little while.
So any expectations? I mean, it's hard to know what it's capable of yet.
I mean, it's easy to know what it's capable of if you're already familiar with the current iPhone, because it really is just kind of a slight bump from the existing iPhone. And it's hard to get excited about that when you see the other thing that Apple also announced that is called an iPhone. It's really kind of complicated. But these, you're going to have the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 8 Plus. The one really big different feature from this is wireless charging. So it's got a glass back now, and the benefit to that is there are special charging mats that you can place the phone on, and it will start charging the phone without having to plug anything into the power cord. And that's something that a lot of Android phones have had for quite a while now. It has never been a particularly popular feature, but it's entirely likely that with Apple putting this feature into so many iPhones that we'll see it become more popular over the next year.
And the iPhone 8 Plus, that's the one that's $1,000?
No.
That's just the iPhone 8. Okay.
That's the iPhone 8. Now we have what is called the iPhone 10 when you say it out loud, but when you read it on paper is the iPhone X.
Okay.
Because for whatever reason, we're shifting from actual numbers to Roman numerals, I guess.
Which is an ongoing issue. Is right. How they name these stupid phones. Okay, go on.
Right. And no one really seems to know what happened to 9. It's the exact same problem that we had with Windows. Windows went from Windows 8 to Windows 10. Ooh. Microsoft and Apple really know something about the number 9 that none of us know about. And I really wish that they would share.
Yeah.
So we have the iPhone 10, and this is wildly different from any other iPhone that Apple has released so far. It has there basically is no home button at all. There is no fingerprint scanner. There is no, special set of buttons on the bottom to access your home, menu or anything like that. It is the front of the phone looks almost entirely screen, very similar to the Samsung Galaxy S8, in the way that it's just, you look at it and it's almost like there's no edge to the phone at all.
Mm-hmm.
A very special set of front facing cameras, that do the same thing on two kind of selfie photos that the dual camera system on the back of the phone does. So you have two cameras that allow you to kind of measure depth, which allow you to do kind of really cool, effects to your photos and kind of add things to your photos as you're taking them. But the really big feature there is that, Apple has made dramatic improvements to the resolution on the display. It looks much sharper and much cleaner. And it really just looks very, very different from what you would expect when you look down at an iPhone.
Do you like it?
I'm kind of a sucker for the smaller phones that have lots of camera capabilities, mm-hmm. and this definitely fits that. So I'm very happy with what I've seen so far. Apple's iPhone Plus models for both last year and this year have this dual camera system on the back that doesn't go on the smaller version of the iPhone. The original iPhone 7 and now the iPhone 8 don't have that secondary camera, which gives you a lot of extra features. So I'm really happy that the iPhone 10 feels much smaller than an iPhone Plus and has a lot of those camera features. So that's something that appeals to me directly.
Are these extra camera features what make the Face ID possible?
Yes. So, a big part of being able to measure, depth is being able to tell the difference between someone's actual face and just a picture of someone's face.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a big problem for phones that offer the ability to unlock a phone with your face is that many of them can be fooled by just a picture of your face, which kind of defeats the purpose. So Apple's doing a lot of work here with depth measuring and with something that they're calling dot measuring, where it's using an infrared projector to kind of put these infrared dots all over your face and then take a picture of those dots. And that creates a depth map is what they call it, so that it's very, very hard to fool with something that's not your actual face. But it is the only method of biometric unlocking that this iPhone 10 has, because there is no fingerprint sensor. So if you want to do something other than a PIN number or a password or something, this face unlock method, Face ID, is the only way that you would have of kind of instantly and conveniently unlocking your phone. But it's still probably not a great idea to use, just because biometrics in general are not like a great idea to use on your phone, because it's really not all that complicated for you to be asleep, for example, and someone just kind of holds the phone up to your face.
Right.
And then the phone is unlocked. And maybe not everyone has that concern that someone's going to be, you know, in your bedroom while you're sleeping and then unlock your phone. It does seem a little unusual, but it's, you know, if you're concerned about other people accessing your phone, it's really hard to hide your face. So that can be kind of complicated.
There's something is another one of those camera things, the portrait lighting. And what is that?
So portrait lighting is kind of it's really just an extension of what Apple started last year with portrait mode on the cameras on the back of the iPhone 7. It has this dual camera system that allows it to measure depth. And part of that is creating this kind of fake version of what's called bokeh photography, where the background is just very, very blurred and the foreground very, very sharp. And so it looks almost like the photo was taken with a much higher quality camera than is normally in a phone. It looks like it's taken with a very professional camera. Over the year, Apple has improved the software, but it's never been, you know, it's never been 100% accurate. It has some weird pitfalls where you'll notice, you know, kind of edges around people that are blurry when they don't need to be. And sometimes when I take pictures of it with my kids, it like blurs half their face for no real reason.
Mm-hmm.
And portrait lighting is taking that idea and adjusting the lighting in the photo as well as the kind of depth that you see. So instead of blurring out the background, they can actually make the background entirely black. To give it this kind of overly dramatic stage lighting effect. And unfortunately, you know, very much in the same way that the portrait mode only works some of the time, this portrait lighting only works some of the time. So you end up winding up with photos that actually kind of look like more like a cardboard cutout of a person than it does an actual photo of someone. And it ends up, you know, with some very bizarre results. But it's the kind of thing that Apple starts out as a beta kind of version of the software, and they improve dramatically over the year as more people use it.
There's another feature called animated emoji. What's that?
I am unnecessarily excited about
this. Okay.
And understand that I
get a grip.
I don't use emoji for anything. Like it drives my kids insane that I don't use emoji, and I am just bizarrely happy about this feature.
What does it do?
It takes, instead of having, you know, just a normal emoji, a static emoji that you send someone, it's actually a video of an animated version of emoji that mimics the things that your face is doing. So if, you know, you look down at your phone and you record this thing, and it's maybe a couple seconds of video, and if you're smiling or your mouth is open or something, then the emoji is doing the same thing. It mimics all of your facial expressions.
Okay, I think that's pretty weird. That's pretty cool.
It is pretty weird, but it also means that I can be a big pink unicorn and send videos to my kids as a big pink unicorn, and this delights me. So I'm going to do a lot of that.
Stand by, Father of the Year Award. Russell, Holly, thank you so much, as always. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having
those
me.
Those lucky kids. That's Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.